Good evening. Right concentration is one of the mental disciplines of the Noble Eightfold Path. It works together with right effort and right mindfulness, which we covered in the past few months. In Sanskrit, it is Sama Samadhi, which sounds nice. Sama is right in the sense of upright. And samadhi is concentration. And it's one of those words that may be familiar to you. It certainly was to me as one of those initially exciting words when I first started seeking spiritual practice. Less suggested meditation, maybe a better word than concentration. I think the meaning of concentration has shifted in modern times somewhat. Concentration in this usage may be confusing because we are so physically focused. And we're so detail-oriented in this culture. And we may be in a super scientific time. And that might be comparable to a period in the past that was more supernatural. And even if we know little about meditation, we know that with some experience that our thoughts and emotions tend to settle down a little bit when we sit. And right meditation is outlined in the text that we have been covering, what the Buddha taught. Is outlined as when these activities stop for some period. Slow down and then stop. Meditation isn't about trying to understand or find anything inside ourselves. It isn't to actively repress thoughts or emotions. If your intellectual or emotional life is in trouble, slowing down could provide you some temporary relief. But this is not what we mean by right meditation. We may do our intensive meditation sessions a disservice by calling them retreats, actually. And that may be because we live in a culture that overemphasizes positive attributes, discrete positive attributes. Some months ago, one of the kids at Dharma School said to me, "I don't want to be free of my thoughts. I like my thoughts." And many people may feel this way. And it's nice that we have kids who are more unabashed about that, expressing what they honestly feel. But people may think that this practice is somewhat odd. Who doesn't want their thoughts? Who doesn't want to feel the richness of life? Who wouldn't want to experience all that life has to offer? And I think the sense then may be that somebody may not be very healthy. They may suspect that at least. And I think that offset of our, you know, positive, the culture that emphasizes positive attributes, and that it's to provide comfort to the negative bias that our mind tends to have. And one of those biases is to maintain a sense of fitness. That's a strong sense that we have. There are many books, accounts of samadhi experience as some kind of peak experience, but either knowledge or accounts of that won't satisfy us. What must concern us is our own practice. And for that, any story must drop away. And we have to go beyond any theory or inspirational cues, beyond any cultural imperatives, and beyond any ideology, including Buddhism. It's the attitude we take in each moment to throw ourselves completely in to the practice. I was thinking earlier about a time a few years ago with my family. We had a reunion on the East Coast, and we were waiting on a waterfront, and we started to skip stones. And I don't know if you have some experience with this. I think maybe most people do, but you know, I started to skip some stones, and then the young ones started to try, and you give them some instructions about what a good stone looks like, and then you teach them how to throw it, and they have to really pay attention at first. It seems like a very mechanical thing, but once you get some experience with it, it's not really. You may have some doubt that you could even skip the stone at first. And that first time you do it as a kid, it's exhilarating. And there's no substitute for it. You skip the stone. It did it just for a moment. And that mechanical idea of it is replaced with the idea of what you did. How did you get there? But no two stones are the same. And the conditions are never the same. And when you scan and find a good stone, you still have to feel it and get a sense of how to grip it. But some of the younger ones were, you know, after a few minutes, my daughter was picking stones that were way too big for her to skip, at least. And my nephew was throwing underhand. And they were just having a great time. They were making the water, making the stones go as far as they could and make a big kerplop. And so I think that, you know, for people who like their thoughts and they're happy to live straight ahead, maybe it's no problem. But in my case, I needed to build a practice that would help me to build this, remove a sense of isolation. The thing is, when you throw that stone and it's released, it's kind of going to do whatever it does, and you don't know. But once it starts skipping, you really are that stone. You're focused completely on that thing. And the throw and the thrower and the stone and the water are all together. You can have the best techniques, but it could still kerplop. But if the conditions are good and you consistently do it, you start to get a sense of being engaged in a larger activity. So picking the stone is just as important as throwing it. You know, maybe if it's a windy day, you wait for the gust to pass. You start to get a larger sense of what you're doing. And so when we sit, we are really just doing one thing within the larger activity of our day. So we have to talk about the conditions we create in our lives also. To sit well, we have to take care of ourselves, and I think an appreciation of moderation increases. A sensitivity to the importance of sleep, the right amount of exercise, adopting a light diet, and then even our choices about what to think about and how to act with discretion. I mean, that might be connected to the division of mindfulness. So you think about how you're going to feel that next day or week or month, and the sensitivity builds. But it may be difficult, especially for the young people, to understand why we limit our activity. And I think we're used to contests in this culture. Sometimes we follow sports where people throw things at targets, or, you know, we form an impressive array of something. But we're training ourselves with this practice to remain calm and building equanimity amidst ups and downs in our life. And so in that way, right concentration is freedom. The experience of that freedom from thoughts and emotions is so profound that our sense of reality, the reality that our mind projects and that the limited self habitually maintains, almost unceasingly in our lives. That projected reality is moved aside for a moment. I think it's also important to say that if you practice with a sense of not suppressing your thoughts, I had seen in the text about repressing thoughts or that may be a sensitive term, but if you accept your thoughts and emotions and don't get involved with them in Zazen, then the whole structure becomes one with you and ceases to be disturbing. I don't know if it goes away or if it's just there and you don't notice it, but I've found that to be the case. And sensitivity to shortcomings can increase. There may be periods where you feel discouraged about yourself. You might feel discouraged about the world. And it's important to have a good teacher who can guide you through these periods. And you, with practice, the determination you need to work through what's limiting you will clarify. And on the other hand, you may come back to the breath with some difficulty if you are in the midst of some exciting insight that arises. And I definitely have this tendency. People in this area may be atypical, extraordinary, because we may have been professionally selected to do certain kinds of work that rely on less defined thought, complex thought, and a culture that trains us to express ourselves creatively. But with practice, you understand that once an exciting insight passes through intellect, it isn't the same anyway. And when you're on your cushion, it isn't the time. So you build a restraint that's needed at the moment it arises. Les told me once that this practice is pretty vanilla. And when I was little, I thought vanilla ice cream was just the word they used for plain. Mm-hmm. When we went to the dairy when I was a kid, I would usually rush by it for a more exciting flavor, like rainbow sherbet or something. But if this practice is vanilla, these mental disciplines, including right meditation, might be like growing vanilla. The effort you need to cultivate vanilla is substantial. I visited a vanilla farm once by accident. I wandered up needing water, and the vines were there, and they had a well, and I sat there, and it's quite beautiful, actually. The vanilla plants are orchids. They're like a green orchid. And it takes years, actually, to grow vanilla. I've read that the vines need to be trained. The flowers have to be hand-pollinated. And then the fruit has to be carefully tended as it dries. And all this is for some concentrated essence that's not really physically nourishing. No, although when you, anytime you cook with it, you can appreciate its wholesomeness. So, I think little by little we grow this practice like this. We learn to appreciate our difficulties. And more than any good feelings you get, you may be encouraged by a sense that you're good for other people. You're good to be around. That's about all I have. And I made some questions that we can go through. But does anyone have any questions tonight? Yes, Umar.
So Travis, you use the word shortcoming, right? Mm-hmm. Is there something called long coming? And the two or three things that I want to ask you. When you were throwing the stones, or when the kids were throwing the stones, none of you were throwing stones, you know that, right? Somebody else was throwing stones. And it was just throwing stones.
Right.
You know, we have no idea of putting definitions and quantifiers and qualifiers and everything. It just throws, you know. And like Suzuki Roshi's book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, he says that you don't sit Zazen, Zazen sits Zazen. Mm-hmm. So it's the same thing, you know, just think about that. Like, you know, that's how the whole idea is just throw the stone, you know, so the whole idea is to sit. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have to find some way to define this subject that's so difficult to define, and maybe analogies cut it sometimes, but that spirit of repetition he talked about, just to continue to practice and work on ourselves, to throw ourselves in to the Zendo, I think is the trick. And that's the long coming we have. It's great that we have this practice in this Zendo.
So what do you do if that person that you normally look for guidance is having a rough time? Or suddenly you feel like, well, now I'm stronger than them. Or, you know, have you ever had a situation where someone you really look up to, whether it's a teacher or even a parent, has really, like, disappointed you? Or how do you do that?
Well, I think when we start off in childhood. I think we need to have people that love us and will take care of us. And not everybody gets that. If we don't have the basic care, then we can be affected for the rest of our lives. And we may compensate in ways that we don't even understand to conform and function within society. And when I started to practice, a lot of feelings came about earlier periods in my life and into childhood, and feelings about what kind of father I was also. And this culture is very hierarchical. So much so that if I tell people that I meet about this practice and what I do, I think they've had more than once people say, so are you a Zen master? We tend to do that, want to look up. And but that working through your shortcomings and building your internal composure, it's for more than you. And I think about banking it now, you know. I'm feeling good, so maybe I can keep going with this, because you don't know what's going to happen in the next moment. So, to be ready to help others and to see everyone as deserving of love. I can say it's, there's a general sense that, a positive sense of people, despite difficulties, people are doing the best they can. And it's an opportunity when someone's struggling to step up. Yes, Teresa.
Thank you, Travis. I really feel like eating a vanilla ice cream in your talk. You know, something that I've been thinking about lately, or something that surprises me, is this, in my experience sitting, is this experience with time, how time contracts and expands, but mainly contracts for me during Zazen. So sometimes I think, you know, it's like I sit and immediately my perception is that almost immediately after a few seconds the light comes in and we are finished. And that makes me think, do I have the right concentration? I mean, is this that I haven't been really paying attention while I sleep, or I don't know, it's just part of my experience, my mind. I was wondering how is it for you? Do you also have this experience or not?
I think I experience that contraction sometimes. Mm. my mind wanders, and I have to bring it back continuously. And in the mornings, I tend to sit with focus on the breath itself. If I'm tired or stressed or in an evening like this, counting the breath helps. I tend to do that more. But I think that sense of time is one reason, or the convention, so many conventions that we have in the day-to-day, in our day-to-day lives, is one reason why counting sometimes is disruptive to me. And time is another convention as well. So I'm always relieved to be free of time for a little while, and I think that's one of the reasons I like to sit.
Yes, again. I enjoy your sticking stone story. One thing I really struggle with is the idea that it's better to let go of joy than move on to equanimity. I feel, but I know through practice that feeling of resistance I have, this uncomfortable kind of nagging existence, usually in my life when I feel that feeling when I'm quiet with it, what comes after is growth to true nature. So if I move through it, then that's what comes. I have a tendency to make those big splashes with the stones to want to go through that. I go from calm to really attached and desiring the joy to want to make a big splash. In your experience, how do you let go of that desire and attachment to the feeling of joy?
Joy and happiness arise just like sorrow and despair, and we sit in zazen to allow these thoughts to come, and then I think not entertain them. So I think right concentration, we may be able to distinguish when we're sitting zazen and in day-to-day life. Zazen may be a training where we know that there's nothing in the Zendo that's going to hurt us. And these patterns in our mind and in our hearts are, they're like momentum that can carry on from our day-to-day lives. And to train seriously and to build up a appreciation that there's an ebb and flow to life, and that we don't need to be so attached. So we build that longer view, I think. This week's not so good. But I'll get through it. I can handle it. That kind of composure, will, I think, grow with practice.
parent being a guide, would be at a parent as your guide, and get right guidance. I was thinking about my childhood, and my mother was not even a high school guide. She was raised in a very small village of India, where she was just homeschooled just to be able to be there, right? Not more than that. So she came from that kind of a culture where there was a distinction between a boy and a girl, or girls and boys too. And I had two brothers. So when we went to school and things happened, I always thought that when I saw her, and then when she got married, she came to meet my father to Bombay, a big city in India. And I always saw my friends in elementary school. They had their moms who were educated, could have gone to college or even high school graduate, and the way they were raised. And I did feel that some things are not right, the way she does parenting, when you have like boys, sons and daughters. And I always thought my father was a role model, and kind of thing. So there is this old song, old movies. It's a very memorable song for me, and in that it is clearly mentioned that if you're looking for a guide, and it's not a guide or a support, and it's not the way that you want, solution is not to sit and cry about it. Try being a support or a guide for someone else. That's the solution. When I became a parent, and I have a boy and a girl, I stopped thinking about that completely. Because you know, they are looking forward to me to be their guide. So am I going to still think about that? Not overcome? No. This is my time to become a guide. So we look forward for the right guidance, the right people. And we grow up, but then there is one time that we need to stop that, and then it's our turn to become a guide, and a right guide, because we are the ones who are distinguishing between the right guidance and the wrong guidance or the way we want it. So it's your turn. So it's like the song clearly said, the solution. So basically, you didn't get the right teaching or the guidance or support you wanted. The solution is very simple. Try to become that guide or support to someone else who needs it. And that's a satisfaction. And that's a lesson. So, in a way, what I feel is like a guide as a parent is basically, parent is a human being. Your parent is not somebody who just came from clouds with perfect label and brand as a parent and then does all the right things. Parent is a human being, a guide is a human being, and can make a mistake. And there can be different opinions. So.
Thank you. Yes, Mike.
Yes, you mentioned during meditation we don't entertain thoughts, but when disturbing thoughts arise that bring with them really painful emotions, or even just a little bit painful emotions, what's the Zen way of dealing with that? Do you just direct your attention back to breath? And if that's what happened, if that's what do you do when they arise again, keep arising during sadhana?
Those thoughts arise and the emotions that come with it, and they can be patterns that repeat. An argument at work, or a loss of a loved one. You know, there's an entertainment of you can stay in that thought too long, or that emotion too long, but also there's an acceptance where you know there's right effort, but without any aggression. We're in a state of alertness, and we have a high energy when we sit. But if there's no aggression towards the thoughts that come, the disturbing thought, it tends to dissipate. And because there's nothing to resist it. If you're really careful, if you carefully examine those events, there's usually a resistance to it. And maybe something you don't want to admit about it, that if you can leave some space, it will sort of punch itself out, like it's fighting a shadow or something. If you don't oppose it, it tends to fall over. So I think that really disturbing thoughts, sometimes you just have to take a break. But that's part of Zazen is accepting things as they arise, and seeing them as not really substantial, actually. Thank you. Yes.
So, sometimes, like when we do Zazen, sometimes, like when we suppress, maybe like long time ago, emotions, and then we don't feel emotions, and so it's easy to actually meditate because we don't really feel much emotions. But then when we are like out in the world and like very few times something happens and then it creates a burst of what feels like an old emotion,
mm-hmm.
but we don't understand what it is. It's just like something, it hits as a joy.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, like, but and then we don't know how to cope with that, and so we do something like, you know, like people will do different things too. So my question is, outside of the practice, if we don't feel what we should feel in the practice, but we feel that outside of the practice, then what should we do? Like, how do we feel that emotion that is not coming to surface? Like, how do we actually feel it?
In the world.
Yeah. So
yes.
But how do I stay open to that? Like,
that's a good question. You practice to build composure in your daily life. If your practice isn't helping those moments, that's okay. That's the challenge, right? So we sit and we collect our thoughts, but there may be something in that moment that you're reacting to that's on a very visceral level that you don't even you don't even in the moment connect the experience with maybe some old trauma that you might have had. So it's great in the sense that you have the practice to come back to, and you have this ability to create some space. It's not detachment, but it's a complete putting yourself in the moment that you don't necessarily need to step away the next time, or you get some more confidence with being in a situation where you're stressed or you are prone to reacting. But at first you're just sitting and you're trying to make sense of the world outside your own point of view, and then as that expands, if you're having a problem with someone else, for example, you're gonna tend to see that person is less of an enemy, more of a person, even in difficult times, and that's a shift that will happen when that objectivity that objectivity of the situation dissipates. I know that one of my questions was that, you know, that Suzuki Roshi said that if you practice zazen to attain various samadhi, then that's a sightseeing practice. And sightseeing, it's like you make a postcard of it, you know, and it's a picture, and you have it becomes a very two-dimensional thing, you know. But we have all these senses, right? So we taste and we feel and we smell, and it's much more rich than that. And in the same way, when you have difficulty in your life, there's so much more texture and dimension to your being in that inner subjective space where this thing is only happening right now. I'm here. It's temporary. It's not the end of the world. I'm going to get through it. Thank you. Yes.
So about that, so at least for me, I would think that this is what I practice when I practice, is to kind of gain more capability to be open to my emotions, because I also often feel like I don't really feel anything, and that usually means that the emotions are all still there, they're just too uncomfortable, and so they're kind of chased away. And I guess the hope is that if I learn to kind of be okay with being uncomfortable, like starting with discomfort, like I want to scratch my nose, then eventually it will build up to me being able to not chase away the bigger things as well.
Yes, I think that's right. Thank you.
You mentioned the right concentration. Do you have an example of wrong concentration?
Well, I think it's more like upright concentration. So wrong concentration is maybe not concentration at all. And we cultivate it, you know? Gets more and more right, maybe. But it's mostly just being upright. And it's general, too. It's more of a sense you get. Giuseppe.
Is there a difference? Is there a fundamental difference between the samadhi, the concentration, the zazen, and the rest of our day?
And the rest of our day?
Yes.
No.
You can't say no.
Well, it is and it isn't. Because, for so many reasons, but what is Zen beyond samadhi? There's so many things, right? And that can include our life. And we have a time here to sit and limit our activity, but we have to go out in the world, and our practice should help that. But we find also that certain situations in our life can create that moment of loss of any separation between subject and object, and people get that inspiration. They have this clarity, and we can see it in art too. People get inspired by something. They have and the great art, you know, everyone sees, that was a very inspired artist. They saw it just as it is. So I think we practice to build that, and maybe there's more of those skips that happen, but those skips can come anytime. So we just set the conditions properly to make our lives, make ourselves ready. Yes?
I think when you gave the analogy of skipping stones, it was really interesting, because once you get the hang of skipping stones, it's very easy to focus on it for long periods. You just love doing it. On the other hand, the zazen is quite hard. When you try to do it, it's quite hard. So, is right concentration just a difference in hardness? So you have to overcome how hard it is to concentrate on some things. And is that it to it?
Skipping stones is easy once you've got the hang of it. But you're not going to get graded on it. There's no skipping average, like batting average in baseball. There's no useful point to it, really. And when we look at our zazen practice, we should have that same attitude. We should be serious about the techniques, but it may only be hard if we're attached to the results of it. And really sitting Yes, we can have some pain in our legs, or we can have difficulty with certain thoughts that arise. But many moments, it may be just coming back to the breath. We have we experience boredom, or we experience frustration, but it's really to come back to the moment is the whole trick, I think. It's not hard in a certain state. So more than any attainment, I think that it's just a consistent effort.
We've got lush growth in the garden and lush weeds in the garden.